Where shall we hide the truth? Where shall we hide the truth from man? The gods all cried when he was made. How can we guard our secret now? They are each of them so afraid. Hide it in the earth, he will mine it. Hide it in the mountain, he will climb it. Even in the sea, he will find it. Where shall we hide the truth from man? Quite beside themselves, they cried, this little guy will take our throne. We have made him far too smart not to claim our heaven home. Hide it in matter, he'll analyze it. Hide it in water, he'll crystallize it. Even in the hell, he'll surmise it. Where shall we hide the truth from man? They thought of stars in outer space or in the nature of a tree, but they knew that man could solve each and every mystery. Hide it in the wind, he'll pursue it. Hide it in an act, he will do it. Even in an atom, he will view it. Where shall we hide the truth from man? Then they solved the mystery of how the frightened gods should win. The wisest said, let's take the truth and hide it deep inside of him. Hide it in his heart, he will doubt it. Hide it in his soul, he'll live without it. Even if we should reveal and shout it, he won't believe the truth's within him. Written by Sebastian Temple for the Phenomenon of Man Project in honor of the work of Pierre Teilhard de Chardin.
And that program, that piece is brought to you as a reference to our conversation today. Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan. Thank you so much for joining us. We come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m. and p.m. Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com. And we also archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. And we are very thankful that you've joined us here on the program. I think that that little poem, which I've been carrying around for, I'm going to say almost 20 years, I was able to get that from actually a program that I went through back in Phoenix with my ex-wife, and was a Monday evening monthly gathering of people who participated in a program, a personal growth and development series called Delta Vector, then renamed Omega Vector, all focused on the same work of Desjardins and other sources as well. As the founder, George Adair, the late George Adair, said, it was from the ancient wisdom teachings. Well, I think that we have a new set of ancient wisdom teachings of sorts with our guest here on the program, whose library I had to erect a whole new shelf just for all of your books, Mark. Mark, is it pronounced Nepo or Nepo?
Nepo. Yes.
I thought I had it right the first time. The one life we're given, finding the wisdom that waits in your heart, which is one of the reasons why I played that little piece. And from my perspective, rather profound, because it is indeed the one place that we don't seem to want to look to find answers. And then, of course, every one of my guests, almost every one of my guests, speaks to going within to find answers, to get that insight. And he has also written 7,000 Ways to Listen, the Endless Practice, the number one bestseller, The Book of Awakening, which we will be talking about, as well as, of course, a couple of other books that I happen to have in my library as well. From what I'm able to discern, Mark Nepo, I've had some of these books in my library for what seems like several years, and this is our first opportunity to really speak and get to know one another. But as to that poem, it is true that, you know, we don't want to go inside, do we?
Well, I think there's a very natural human, you know, approach avoidance. You know, it's very interesting. If we look at nature, you know, what we look at, we travel on vacation, we go to these great places where actually nature has eroded mountains and rivers and cliffs to their beauty, to their inner beauty. And, you know, the friction of life, the friction of the wheel of life, is that suffering and difficulty, like it or not, are part of what is human erosion. And in some ways, and I'm not advocating it, nobody wants to sign up for it, but it's kind of part of the physics of living, is that, you know, we are broken open so that our inner beauty can reveal itself. And in a kind of sweet, bittersweet kind of paradox, it seems that life has been made just difficult enough that we need each other to ensure the journey of love. And I know that, so it's very, you know, with compassion for ourselves, it's very understandable that when we meet fear and pain and worry and disappointment and grief and loss, we pull away. That's a, kind of a, an immediate reflex. And part of the spiritual practice is, after we do that, how do we lean back in? Because what's opened by these currents and the weather of circumstance is what's most important. And when we can hold nothing back and lean in, we find or refine our kinship with the living universe. And then we are strong, but we're more than just our own strength. We touch into the resources of life.
You know, it's one of the silver threads, if you will, or maybe it's a golden thread that runs through, again, many of the conversations that we have on this program. And it is impossible to escape if you're genuinely searching for understanding of who we are and why we're here and where we're going, if not only where we've been as well. You're going to run into yourself. And I find it was really fascinating as I mean, I was in my single digit years in the 60s, so I wasn't part of that. I'm going to go find myself culture. But when I started learning about that, and then I started learning from a metaphysical and spiritual perspective about one's life, my life, I had to chuckle at that phrase. Because it's like, wait a minute, where are you going? You don't have to go anywhere. You know, it's great you want to travel and see the world, but, you know, you're right where you need to be.
And you know, this is the great Hindu sage, Ramana Maharshi, said, you know, one of the great paradoxes of life is that we are constantly seeking reality when, in fact, we are reality. But, you know, I think it's also, it doesn't mean that we're all, therefore, we just sit and do nothing and are not engaged in life. I think one of the things I've learned is, like fish that have to move through water to breathe, we have to keep moving through life, but there's really nowhere to go. The whole point is to engage in relationship, at that through relationship spirit comes alive. And one of the images that and you know, the images and metaphors that I come upon through feeling and question and my own struggle with life's difficulties, they become my teachers, and then I write about them. And one of these images that came in the beginning of The One Life We're Given is of a wooden match, you know, that you would light a fire with or light a stove with. Well, we all know that in an unlit match, the fire and the light and the warmth is dormant in the tip of that match, and it doesn't reveal itself until you strike that match against the surface. And the metaphor that's the teacher is that every human being, every soul on earth is such a match, and our gifts, like the unlit tip of the match, our gifts wait dormant inside us until our gifts strike against the needs of the world. Then the heat and warmth and love and light that we carry within us come alive. And I might dream that I need to be this or that, or, you know, run a business or go here or go there or do this. And all of it is just so that I can strike against the needs of the world so my gifts will light. Where I think I'm going isn't often where I'm going.
Yeah, well, that's true. That is absolutely true. Although there are times when I would love to just hit the road and not care, you know, just to see what comes up, that adventure, if you will. I flew from Santa Barbara to Phoenix to visit my parents for their wedding anniversary just recently, and I took the flight over, and uneventful, had a great conversation with this incredible woman who lives there in Gilbert, Arizona. And I mean, the conversation was fantastic, and hopefully we'll have her on the program in the not too distant future. But on the return flight, I had been asked by the airlines, would you be willing to take a $300 voucher and take the next flight? And I said, well, no, I'd really like to get home. You know, it wasn't hard and fast, but I figured, somebody else will. I probably get to the airport, get to the gate. We're offering $500. And then it went up to $700 and then $800. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to call my own shot. I'll go up there and just ask. I mean, it can't hurt to ask. Could I get two round trip tickets for the week of Thanksgiving to Phoenix from Santa Barbara for two? Well, it doesn't really work that way, sir. Okay, I understand. I had to put it out there. But I thought, you know what? If I got bumped because they had to use a smaller plane and I couldn't fly home at that time that my ticket said, I wasn't going to worry about it. It didn't matter because I was just going to look at it as this is part of the adventure. It's part of the fun, you know, and we don't often look at our lives that way. It's so serious and so, you know, that's going to be detrimental to my the core of my being if I have to take the next flight. No, it won't be.
Well, yeah, you know, that points up. Let me share with you this one of the poems from The Way Under the Way. It's called Not According to Plan, and it's on page 199, Not According to Plan. When I drop my glasses in the airport and they're crushed in the walkway between terminals, I get to meet the three kind souls who helped me on my way. Then I hear you crying after everyone has left, so I bring you water and hear your story. Ever since the lock on my door broke, I have more visitors. Now, the road I always take is detoured, which I curse until I see the heron glide across the small pond I didn't know was there.
And this is a beautiful book, too, by filled with poems that you've put together. I want to ask this question, and again, as I do quite often throughout these programs when these kinds of questions come up, I ask this with all due respect, Mark. Why do you give a damn? Why don't you just go live your life, leave the rest of us alone, and keep your journey private? Why does this matter to you?
Because this is the way I breathe. This is the way that I live. That, you know, that I have come to understand, and, you know, in my books, you've probably come across, I'm a long-term cancer survivor, and I'm in my 60s and in my 30s. I almost died from a rare form of lymphoma. And so, you know, my whole understanding of art changed, being blessed to still be here. And it's, you know, it's about the healthy journey of expression, that just in the way that we're speaking, we have to inhale and exhale. You can't not, or you won't be here. Well, the heart needs to open and close. We need to perceive and feel and express and be in relationship to live. And so, you know, I feel like I'm an inner explorer, and therefore a constant student. And so my writings are the trail of that exploration, and my teaching is the conversation with others about comparing notes on what it is to be here. And so, you know, it's a form of love, and I do it not, you know, out of just, you know, being kind or altruistic. I do it because when we're talking like this, I'm more alive. Mm. Our conversation helps me be more here and glow and come alive. And so it's food. It's inner food. It's inner air to breathe. Mm.
You have a wonderful poem on the back of the book, The Way Under the Way, called Free Fall. If you have 1 hour of air and many hours to go, you must breathe slowly. If you have one arm's length and many things to care for, you must give freely. If you have one chance to know God and many doubts, you must set your heart on fire. We are blessed. Each day is a chance. We have two arms. Fear wastes air. And I have to say that when I was reading that, And a thought came to mind, the closing line of the intro to the original series Star Trek that says, to boldly go where, and I modify it, most men don't want to go. And it doesn't...
But you know, we're...
Go ahead.
Well, we're, you know, our resistance is understandable, but our challenge is not to make a god of our resistance. To have compassion for our resistance. You know, it's interesting, and it's just that, you know, the whole relationship between light and openings, you know, light will fill, just like water will fill any hole, light will fill any opening. And therefore, you know, part of the human erosion we were talking about of being living in the weather of life is that we are cracked. We are, but every crack is an opening. And in the Tibetan mythology, it is said that a spiritual warrior, that's one who is committed to a life of transformation, a spiritual warrior always has a crack in their heart, because that is how the mysteries get in. And every tradition has a different version of this. And so, you know, though we resist and it's understandable, it's what is opened in us is more important than whatever opens us.
Interesting. And it's really fascinating for me as I move through my life, and I'm headed towards 60, just turned 57, As I do these interviews and converse with folks such as yourself, and by the way, folks, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Mark Nepo. By the way, his website, marknepo.com, is a place you can go to find out all about Mark and the work that he's doing, and we're going to continue talking about that. But I find it interesting that even now, and I don't know if that has anything to do with age and or any wisdom that I have managed to pull together, that I'm finding that all of these various pieces, yours and other guests' pieces that I take in, I can't escape this growing, I don't want to say this growing puzzle, because I keep getting more pieces, and that I can't just compartmentalize. That everything that I am becoming aware of adds to what I knew before and might slightly shift, not just my awareness, but maybe my beliefs, my understanding, and so forth. And then, of course, the conversation continues and we find out new things, and that adds more and more and more and more. Kind of like education is supposed to be, you know, in our modern world. So I'm trying to take advantage of that spiritual enlightenment, if you will, and not in a haughty way, in a very humble way. That, gosh, I'm so, from a mental perspective, an intellectual perspective, I am so finite in my understanding, and that there's so much out there, and that's why we do these programs, because there's so much out there. I want to bring in as many people as I can. I hate turning people away for interviews just because, well, I don't have the time this week, or I can't schedule you in. I want to find the time to talk with you and to, and then hopefully to grok from you, coming from Stranger in a Strange Land, to assimilate into every atom in my being what you're talking about, so that even if I don't agree 100% with every single word you've said, there are bits and pieces that fit into my awareness, my understanding, and then I get to move forward.
So I love that, and you know, and there are two things that brings up for me, and that are great teachings for me, you know, and you know, one comes from the Native American elder councils, and how elder councils still meet today, and they meet in circle. And they don't meet in circle just for equity, just because there's no head to the circle. They meet in circle because they need everybody's view, so that everybody will have a direct view of the center, because they need everyone's view to glimpse and feel and understand the center. And what I love about that, and what I so profound, is that we gather meaning, we don't choose it. You know, in a world that is so polarized today, and this comes and goes and cycles throughout history, but we're in a time that's very polarized. As I get older, I'm not really interested in argument, debate, persuasion. We need everybody's view. We add meaning. We gather it. We don't choose one over another. And so that begs us to listen and absorb and integrate. And so, you know, one of the things that's happened, I think, growing through the years and shifting and changing, and it's very natural, I think, in the beginning, you know, in our first half of life, we are really kind of consumed with who am I and what are my unique gifts and what contribution can I make and what separates me from all other life? How do I know that this is me and I don't blur with everything? But what happens, I think, it's happened to me anyway, and I think it's pretty archetypal. And somewhere in the second half of life, and of course, it's hard to know where that shift begins, you know, moves from the first half to the second half. But, you know, now actually it's I'm looking for what I have in common with all life, not how I'm different.
Yeah.
And that's what brings me alive and in a paradoxical way affirms who I am. And so, you know, part of that is, you know, we start out looking for what is special, but in time we start to look for what is special in everything. And it's a, you know, a very, so one of the things that happens and how we learn for me, and I think this is common, is we're taught at a very early age how to, you know, analyze, sort, prioritize, and choose. It's how we navigate the world, the surface world. And it's a wonderful skill to have, but it's not a code to live by. Problem solving is not a god. It's a skill.
Yeah.
And what's happened, though, is that the experiences of life have made me say, well, that's fine. How do you know, I need to go to the grocery store and, you know, not pick up something that's not edible and eat it.
Yeah.
I do need to choose. But the things that matter, I'm not asked to sort and choose. I'm asked to absorb and integrate. I'm asked to take everything into my heart and hold it until it releases a deeper logic of the spirit. You know, the great Jewish philosopher Martin Buber said, the world is incomprehensible, but it is embraceable.
And there is a distinct difference between the two. You know, you talk about problem solving is a technique, not a god, a way of life. I've lived by the philosophy that you work with what you have until you get what you want, and that when there are those challenges, those problems, there is always a workaround. It just depends upon how long you're willing to, you know, pursue a solution to whatever the situation happens to be, and not give up. You know, you mentioned something else too in regards to observing the world and learning lessons from the various, in our polarized time right now, for some, it's very difficult to sit and go, my teacher. This is my teacher today, and what can I learn from this particular, and in this case, it's people, not so much events, but people. What can I learn from this person today? In spite of the fact that maybe on a religious or political or educational or whatever framework you want to come at it from, I have problems with this person. I can't stand this person. This person's an idiot. This person's whatever, you know, the case might be. Setting all of that aside and saying, and it's a hard one to say, especially if you have friction with this other person, even if you don't know them, maybe they're in the news or what have you, to say, this is my teacher. I am this person's student. Now, that doesn't mean that every word that comes out of this person's mouth is something that you adhere to, because in this polarized time, I look at certain individuals as teachers saying, and you are teaching me how I don't want to behave. This is not how I want to be. And I take a look at some of the actions of folks and I say, okay, set aside the politics, set aside the frustration, the anger, the angst, etc. What was the decision they made? And what is the conversation that it has brought forth that wasn't there before? And what can we learn from it?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the powerful things, especially in a time like this, and it's a deep humbling paradox, is no matter how different we are they.
Yes.
There's no they.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as I've been thinking and writing about where we are, you know, it's made me think in history and to go back. And so there, you know, I imagine that there are two basic deep tribes that we belong to. And actually we are members of both, depending on how we wake up each day. But imagine in the beginning of time, that when the first one human being came upon another. And, you know, imagine that maybe from, they looked at one person, looked in the cave and saw the other, and the one in the cave saw a different being, and their first reaction was, you're different, go away.
Mm.
And I think that might have been the beginning of the go away tribe, that out of fear says, wait a minute, don't get any closer. And then the extremes throughout history of that have been, well, I can't trust, I'm so afraid, I can't trust you will go away, so I have to contain you. I have to put you on a reservation or in a camp or in a detention center or in a ghetto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even at the worst, that fear gets so strident that, and this, you know, is at the heart of all the genocides, terrible genocides and killings we've experienced throughout history. I can't even trust that you'll go away. I have to make you go away.
Mm.
But on the other side, the person outside the cave, that original person, sees someone different, and his response is, or her response is, oh, you're different. Come teach me. And I think that was the beginning of the come teach me tribe. You know, Plato had said, one of the things Plato said is we're born whole, whole, but we need each other to be complete. So there the assumption, like the Native American Elder Council, is we're more together than alone. Thank God you're not like me. Come teach me what I don't know.
Yeah.
We're more together than alone. I think all the periods of enlightenment have been from the extremes and the manifestations of the come teach me tribe. And so, you know, every generation gets to play this out, and we're at a tipping point, which worldwide, not just in America.
Right.
Which is in the foreground now, you know, the come teach me tribe or the go away tribe. And you know, every day we are they, like, depending on how much fear I wake up with, you know, I want to believe that I'm part of the come teach me tribe. But, you know, I have to accept that that lives in me, too. Depending on how frightened I get on any one day, I can slip and, be, you know, assume my membership in the other tribe. And then I need you to remind me that we're more together than alone.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is the purpose of love and relationship and true education.
Mark Nepo is my guest. We're talking about a lot of wonderful things, especially in relation to the work that he's done. He's written 17 books, and I envy you that because I've been working on my book for 17 years. And I just won, and you've done 17. So I've got a long way to go, and eventually I'll get those words out on the paper. Actually, I have most of them. I just haven't finished it. But I made the commitment for the 2017 I would finish my book. So I still have a little time, and we have a little more time, too. We're going to continue here on Tell Me Your Story with Mark Nepo. And his website is Mark Nepo, MarkNe. That's N as in Nancy, EPO.com. Stay tuned. This is Tell Me Your Story.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan along with Mark Nepo, and we're conversing about a lot of wonderful inner work things, if you will. I always enjoy these programs because of the fact that they take you places. As I mentioned in the first half of the program, these conversations open up doorways to things that I never thought of before, and that's the whole point. Is to consider new ideas, new possibilities, new ways of living is what we're looking for, those new paradigms for a new world. And, you know, we're going to get there. I promise you we will get there eventually, depending upon what it is that we want. And I know that kind of goes, that's kind of a conversation we might have too, Mark, in terms of this whole aspect. I heard years ago, even when I was working for the Christian radio station, I was very much into my metaphysical and spiritual searchings, and I kept hearing from those secondary circles, the metaphysical and spiritual circles, you create your own reality. And so I thought, well, okay, I kind of get that, sort of. You know, I know how to build models, so I can create a model from all of the parts that are there that are nothing until I put them together. But I even had to take that to the next step, going, okay, well, as far as I know, I didn't create myself. And so here I am in this world. And if God had intended, as you were talking earlier about the two different tribes, the Go Away and the Teach Me tribes, there are sufficient M-class planets in the universe for every single one of the 7.5 billion people to occupy solo. However, the reality that we've created is we're all here together. And that must mean something. That must be significant.
Well, I think that, you know, and I hold, you know, the whole notion that we create our own reality. I mean, I hold it a little differently. And, you know, I think that the extreme of that I find to be kind of a little bit hubris in our humanity, to the part of us that wants to play God rather than be God-like, and that we can control everything. And we certainly participate, and everything we do and our intentions and everything matters. But my experience has been that, you know, we're asked that our dreams and our goals and our ambitions are kindling for the fire of aliveness that lives in our heart. And that, again, just like we were talking about, problem solving is not a God. You know, I found in my own life that I need to want things, to yearn, to learn, to grow and reach for things. But they often are bringing me as stepping stones to being alive in a way I couldn't have imagined. They're kindling on that fire of aliveness. So, you know, I love, there's a beautiful quote by Nietzsche, the German philosopher, which is very different from most of his work. And says, because of his early work is very much about will and the power of the individual. And so later in life, he had this very different quote, which I so love. It goes like this. He said, "I want to see what is necessary as beautiful, so I can be one of those who makes things beautiful."
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think that what I've learned is, it doesn't mean we don't have dreams and goals and ambitions and look forward to things, but to be open enough, like you were about your trip back from Phoenix, to be open enough to say, well, I give this my all, but I don't pretend to know where it's going. And so I think we are asked to work with what we're given. And let me tell you, there's two short, small stories that are wonderful examples of this. The first is, I have a book, one of my books is a book of teaching parables and stories. And this is the opening story in that. That book is called As Far as the Heart Can See. And the opening story, very short story, it's like, you know, one page. And it's about a bicyclist, a professional cyclist who is training very, very hard for like a Tour de France type race. And, you know, he's got all the state-of-the-art equipment. He's shaved the hair off his body so there's less resistance. He's into it. And so what happens is he's finally, the day of the race, they're off, and he's doing well. In fact, after the first mile or two, he's coming over the top of the hill, and he is so far ahead for the moment that as he comes down to the bottom of the hill, you can't see the other racers. And just as he gets to the bottom of the hill, as he's gliding, you know, coasting down that hill, out of nowhere, a great blue heron swoops with its wings fully spread over his handlebars, and it stuns him. He actually stops and straddles the bike because the heron had opened something he'd been chasing. Mm. And the other racers start to catch up, and now we cut to years later. And if you find him looking out his backyard, out his porch, into the woods, and once in a while, if you ask him, what cost you the race? Once in a while, they'll say to you, I didn't lose the race. I left it. And that's the end of the story.
Mm.
And what's so powerful about, now again, I didn't like say, oh, I'm going to write a story and we'll have it wind up there. I retrieved that story and discovered its ending and was just faithful to writing it down. And so I said, well, what is that story, what is it trying to say or teach me? And so having to have been with it and having to tell it several times until I could understand it, what it says to me is, you know, he didn't train, he thought he was training to win the race, but I think he was training to meet the heron, which changed his life. Now, someone might say, well, he did lose the race. He didn't come in first, he lost. Well, again, I hold it differently, because if you had told him he was training to meet a heron, he wouldn't have trained.
Yeah, exactly.
Likewise, we work years toward goals, and then the goals crumble for some greater, different purpose that shows itself. So another story that's from history that is really a beautiful example of this is there was a monk, a Japanese monk in the 1700s in Japan, 1600s, excuse me, in Japan, by the name of Tetsugen. Now, Tetsugen's dream, he felt called at an early age, no one had ever translated the teachings of Buddha into Japanese at that point. And so he wanted to do this. He felt it was his call in life. And so he began to translate them, and he had an artist friend who was going to do beautiful woodblock prints to go along with it. And they worked, and they begged alms to have enough money to publish this beautiful edition of Buddha's Dharma Talks. Well, after 10 years, they had enough money, and at that time, there was a flood in the northwest part of Japan where Tetsugen grew up, much like Katrina here in America. And he said, oh, I got to help them, and he gave all the money to help the people where he grew up endure the flood and survive. And then they worked for another 8-9 years and saved more money and kept translating and doing woodblock prints. And if at that time what happened, there was a famine somewhere else in Japan. And he said, well, I've learned from all this that just because I didn't grow up there, these are still my people. And so he gave the money away again. And after 25 years, he finally published this beautiful edition of Buddha's Dharma Talks in Japanese. And today, there is a copy, an original of that, in a museum in Kyoto. And under it, there is a plaque that reads, Tetsugen published in his lifetime 3 versions of the holy text. Only one is visible.
Mm. Wow.
And so, he did in fact still do what he thought he was meant to do, but what he was really meant to do is work with what he was given so that, like I said earlier, his gifts struck against the needs of the world by working with what he was given, and he was supposed to embody the teachings of Buddha more than translate them.
Yeah. You know, wow, as you're sharing that story, I've been in broadcasting for almost 40 years, feeling that that is my life's purpose. Now, I've diverted from that a couple, three times in the middle to working in a warehouse, working for a multi-level marketing company, and so forth. And I actually started out my working career, period, as a paperboy. You know, I was in high school. Then I worked for, after I got out of high school, or shortly after, worked for a photo lab processing film and hadn't decided yet. One of the things that has come clear to me over the course of my life is that there is never any wasted time. That no matter what you are doing, no matter where you are, and no matter who you are with, just like the puzzle pieces I was talking about before, these experiences, if you will, are training you for what you do not know. You don't know what piece of the bigger picture down the road for you this is going to fill. And whereas a lot of people, oh gosh, I hate this job or I hate this place I live and I wish I was somewhere else and so on and so forth. When in fact you're there for a particular reason, maybe to get you ready for the next step in your journey that may be totally different. And I, as you're sharing the story, I'm thinking, well, is this program and broadcasting really, you know, my purpose, or am I being trained for something else, you know, and that I don't even know about yet?
Right, and the humbling thing is that I think we are asked to devote ourselves completely with an open heart to whatever is before us, mm-hmm. and it will lead us to what we're called to, even when we can't see it.
Yeah. Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. Let me ask you to continue on in this direction. Let me ask you about your understanding, your awareness, if I can borrow that term there, of intuition and its role in our lives.
Well, I believe that intuition is a way in which, intuition speaks to all the learnings and the innate connections we have at birth. It was an old Greek, in the old Greek times, one of the beautiful kind of, if the Greeks were, even though we consider them, a great civilization, but they were their own indigenous tribe in a way, and they had their myths. And one of their lovely understandings was that when you're born, you know everything when you're born, and when you come out and cry, it all escapes. And the journey of life is to regain everything you already knew, piece by piece, experience by experience, love by love, disappointment by disappointment. I love that. And I think that, so intuition is the deeper form of knowing by which we glimpse another and another piece of what we were born with. And I think it's much quicker and deeper than, again, like we were talking about problem solving. The mind is an amazing thing. It's a great tool, but I wouldn't give it the keys to the car. Right?
Yeah.
It's the steering wheel, but it doesn't steer itself.
Right, right.
It's the heart and soul that steer us, and intuition is the, a way that I think, the mind and our rationality and our reason and our precision is like ladder thinking. It helps us go step by step, which again is necessary to put things together, to take things apart, to navigate the world, okay? But intuition is like constellation thinking. Intuition sees patterns. And mm-hmm. then the patterns bring enlightenment. The patterns bring moments of bringing the light we carry within out, which is another way to understand enlightenment. to bring that out. So intuition to me is how we, which is why it's very dear to me as a poet. I was just born this way. A poet is that, you know, is always looking for how things go together, and intuition is how we see the patterns. So for me, you know, poetry, being a poet is how intuition and the heart interfaces with the mind to keep revealing how things go together. And the philosopher in me then tries to understand what those patterns mean.
Hmm. You know, I have never been a poet, never fully understood poetry. However, when I was working in my 20s for a particular station, we had to read certain things, and poetry was one of those things that we had to read. And I was told, you read poetry really well. This was out loud, of course. And I thought, well, that's great. I hope I'm understanding what the heck I'm reading, just because I'm reading it so well, as you put it. Yet it's one of those art forms that I think for a lot of folks is so misunderstood. And yet you, as you say, you know, you were just born a poet.
Well, I think we all, because I think we've been educated away from what poetry truly is.
About
this in the beginning of The Way Under the Way, because to me, poetry, and this is where being, you know, you add the poet, the philosopher, and the cancer survivor, you know, poetry isn't some abstract, I mean, we've been taught it's this kind of abstract, difficult way of expressing things, you know, in school. And even me too, when I was little and in school, you know, it was, I first encountered poetry. This wasn't what I came to understand it to be as I grew as a young man, okay? Poetry is the unexpected utterance of the soul that comes to renew us.
Mm.
And so when we talk about it that way, it doesn't matter whether you write it down or not. Whenever there's a moment of authenticity between two people, or between you and life, that's a moment of poetry.
Mm.
So I'll give you, and we'll go back to Nietzsche for a minute in his life story, because, you know, and so this is another way of learning, actually. You know, so when I came across that quote I mentioned about seeing what is necessary is beautiful, that was so unlike all of Nietzsche that I said, you know, how did he come? What happened to this guy? This is right. This is like an about face on this. And so I realized while I read a lot in college of his work and everything, like other people, I didn't really know anything about him. So now what? I started to find the story behind the story.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always a story behind the story.
Oh, yeah.
And that's part of yeah.
Yeah.
So this is the story behind the story with Nietzsche. He lived to be 54, but when he was 44, he had a transformative experience. He was in a hotel in Turin, Italy. He looked out the window, and in the square, someone was whipping a horse. This is in 1889, right? Someone was whipping a horse, and all of a sudden, it cracked him. Like, there was nothing between him and the horse. Everything had been removed. He ran out into the square, and he tried to get the guy to stop whipping the horse, and the guy said, hey, it's my horse. I'll do what I want. Who are you? And Nietzsche threw his arms around the neck of the horse and put himself between the whip and the whipped.
Hmm.
And he was never the same. He had a, quote, breakdown. And it's been argued ever since, what was that of people who want to believe in early Nietzsche, who was all about the will and that we can impose ourselves on any situation and form our own destiny. Those people want to say, well, he had a breakdown. Forget everything that happened after that. But mystics like Maya Baba from India wrote about Nietzsche and said, no. Forget everything that came before. That was the moment of his transformation.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And he wrote that quote that I was drawn to after that moment. And so when we talk about poetry with a capital P, not as words written on a page, but the unexpected utterance of the soul, I would say for all the brilliant words that he wrote, that moment was the poem of his life.
Yeah. It makes me also think of that moment in Buddha's life when he sat at the base of the Bodhi tree and it finally dawned on him, oh, I have to stop searching to find. To paraphrase.
Yeah. Right.
You know? And that's the way it is for, you know, well, quite honestly, for all of us. I just find it so extraordinary, the path that I took. I was within the confines, so to speak, not literally, of a Christian radio station, and yet I was searching and researching all other kinds of philosophies and religions, even at one point becoming a member of the Baha'i faith, and for about a year and a half. And curious about all these different things. And yet there I was, right in the heart of this Christian bastion. And I remember when I left, because I was moving on to other things, my boss said, he says that I was a casualty of Christian radio, because I didn't toe the party line. And I thought, casualty? Far be it for me to be a casualty. I don't see it that way at all. Because
right,
you gave me the opportunity to talk to and question people, even people you don't even know I talked to. I remember even doing an interview with a gentleman who was part of an organization called CAMP, Camp, Christians and Muslims for Peace. And this was back in the late 80s, mind you. And I did the interview, and he was talking in the Phoenix area following the interview, mentioning that the interview was going to be on that station. And he had this woman who followed him around, his heckler. And she called me at the radio station. She called the station number and basically said, you're being used of the devil. And my boss didn't like surprises. So I called him and I said, hey, I got this phone call. I did this interview, blah, blah, blah. I need to listen to the interview, he says. Okay, sure. Ran off a copy, sent it to him. First question out of his mouth when he called me a few days later was, are you a Muslim? Like, what does that have to do with anything in reference to this interview? Well, we aired the interview with a couple of conditions, and didn't hear one word out of anybody after the interview aired. Matter of fact, that was the only time I ever received any kind of input, plus or positive or negative, about any interview that I did for the 15 years I was there. And I was interviewing people like yourself, who didn't necessarily speak the right words that fit with that format or come from the right perspective fit with that format. And yet I was still interviewing people because I used the terminology, because I understood where ownership, management, advertisers, programmers, and listeners were coming from. So I actually opened up that dialogue.
Yeah, and so that's beautiful, and you know that you share that. It's a great example of the difference between the go away tribe and the come teach me tribe.
Yeah.
You know, in my life, and this is with my cancer journey, you know, I was raised Jewish, and I'm Jewish by heritage, but when I went through almost dying, I was blessed to have people from all faiths and all walks, and we opened that way up. That includes atheists and scientists, as well as indigenous people and Sufis and Christians. I've had people from all faiths kindly care and offer me some kind of blessing or kindness. So when I was spit out of the mouth of a whale of cancer like Jonah, and I was still here, I was not and still not wise enough to know what worked and what didn't. And I felt that I was challenged to believe in everything. And all my work, all these last 25, 30 years, all my books have all, I'm a student of all paths. And my work, my devotion is to illuminate the common center of all paths and lift up the unique gifts of each.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
The teacher in me is committed to trying to say, well, how can we apply that to our daily lives?
And in the Baha'i faith, it teaches, if you reject one messenger, you reject them all. If you accept one messenger of God, you accept them all. And
that's beautiful.
That's huge for a lot of folks to assimilate, because they have been following only one, and in essence rejecting all of the others, because this one is, well, this is the only one. This is the only path. That's what I was taught in that arena, was that there was only one path to spirituality. And yet every other path in life, whether it was what you ate or drank or what educational system, what education you got, what job you wanted, there were a myriad of choices. But when it came to spirituality, nope, only one. And I thought, that doesn't make any sense. And that's one of the big reasons why I searched as fervently as I did. And I'm still searching. I know that we all are. But now,
yeah,
I think my search is a little different. Please, go ahead.
Yeah, so let me, you know, offer this as we're coming to our, you know, end of our time. So this poem, it's a short poem on page 53 from The Way Under the Way, called If You Want a True Friend. If you want a true friend, just open your hands and say, I don't know. Say it softly and wait so your other can see that you mean it. Give them a chance to drop what they think is secret. Let them come up with a cup of what matters from the spring they shall know one. Let them sigh and admit that they don't know either. Then you can begin with nothing in the way. Go on, admit to the throb in your heart, and let the journey begin.
Mm. Very profound. I you know what, folks? I highly recommend Under the Way, The Place of True Meeting. That is just one of 17 works, and I'm sure that's not the end, Mark Nepo, of what you're going to be sharing with us over the coming years of your life, and I'm sure you have many, as I'm hoping we both do, have many, many years to come. I have to outlive my great-grandmother, who lived to be 101, so I got a ways to go.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that I can also stay in excellent health. And I'm doing well right now, so I'm going to try to continue to maintain that. I want to thank you so much, Mark, for sharing so much time with us. And before we let you go, of course, first of all, I'd like to open up this invitation to you that should you find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
Oh, thank you. That'd be terrific. Thanks so much.
And then a reminder, too, folks, that his website, Mark Nepo, MarkNepo.com, is the website. You can find more information there as well. And I have three final questions for you that I ask my guests as we come to the close of our hour together. And the first question is, who is Mark Nepo?
Oh, you know, I am just, I'm a piece of spirit carried in a body like everyone else. You know, when I was going through cancer and almost died, there was a point where for a brief moment, I forgot my name. And so I live under names. I mean, I'm Mark. If you call me Mark, I'll respond. But, you know, I'm a conduit. I am devoted to the presence of life, and to just bringing that as between people and alive in people as best I can.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Well, all of my work, I feel like my job and my desire is to introduce people to their own gifts and their own wisdom. Because I believe we're more together than alone, and that only comes from each of us being completely who we are.
And what is your life's purpose?
Oh, my life's purpose is like that match. And my life's purpose is to hold nothing back and light as many gifts as I can along the way.
Thank you again, Mark Nepo, for joining us here on the program. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.